Hello, angels. It is me, Willow. I am here with Chapter 8 of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. If you have not heard Chapters 1 through 7, I suggest you go back and listen to them, or else this might not make a lot of sense. Unless you're just looking to listen to me talk, in which case, I'm flattered, confused but flattered, and carry on if you please. But if you're looking for Chapters 1 through 7, they are pinned in the media channel of my Discord. They are also at the very bottom of my audio index, which is pinned to my profile on Reddit. This is a completely safe for work audio, and if you're looking for not safe for work audios, I suggest you scroll on up in that aforementioned audio index and you pick something up there. I'm a bisexual switch. There is something pretty much for everybody up there. My ramble faps tend to lean pretty subby, and my improvs tend to lean pretty dommy, and I'm sure that I will switch that in the future, but for now, that's just how it is. I hope you find something that you like and something that floats your boat, but if not, also I won't be upset. Let's see, this is my favorite book. It is almost over, and I'm glad that you guys got to take this journey with me, because I don't get to share things like this with people very often. As such, this book is something that was written set in the 1920s, and there's a few trigger warnings that you should know about. Unsurprisingly, there is racism. Racism is pretty prominent. It either comes out of Nick or Tom's mouth most of the time. It's not violent racism, but it is still racism, and it's still hurtful. And if you don't like that, that's totally fine. I hate it as well. It's not fun. It's not great. Also, there's a lot of sexism. There's sometimes, like, physical abuse. Tom has punched the shit out of his significant others. Somebody died last chapter. It's a book. It's got some stuff in it. I do my best to warn you as best I can, but I don't remember what happens in each chapter, so I can't tell you what's coming because I don't have time to pre-read these things. So, if that's something that worries you or bothers you, I don't blame you at all, and you are more than welcome to skip this one. Anyhow, I think that's it. I think that's all of my spiel. Just get comfy and cozy. I'm gonna read this chapter to you. I'm settled up in bed. I've got on my knee socks. I've got something to drink. I've got the fairy lights on. I took a shower. My hair's all clean. So I'm here. And this chapter is, let's see, not that long. It's like 15 pages, which is very short in comparison to yesterday's chapter. But, like I said, this is the second to last chapter, so after this, there will only be one more Gatsby recording. Brace yourselves, I'm gonna be sad about it too. Maybe after that I will, if you're interested, and please do let me know if you're interested, maybe I'll do some sort of, like wrap-up where I talk about the book and the things that matter to me, and I go back and I read to you the quotes that are underlined and explain why they're important. If that is something you're interested in, that's super okay. Like, that's super fine. I won't be upset. But anyway, I've rambled for over 3 minutes, and I'm going to start reading now. So, here is Chapter 8 of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. I couldn't sleep all night. A foghorn was groaning incessantly on the sound, and I tossed half-sick between grotesque reality and savage, frightening dreams. Towards dawn, I heard a taxi go up Gatsby's Drive, and I immediately jumped out of bed and began to dress. I felt that I had something to tell him, something to warn him about, and morning would be too late. Crossing his lawn, I saw his front door was still open and he was leaning against a table in the hall, heavy with dejection or sleep. "Nothing happened," he said wanly. I waited, about 4 o'clock she came to the window and stood there for a minute, and then turned out the light. His house had never seemed so enormous to me as it did that night when he hunted through the great rooms for cigarettes. We pushed aside curtains that were like pavilions and felt over the innumerable feet of dark wall for an electric light switch. Once I tumbled with a sort of splash upon keys of a ghostly piano. There was an inexplicable amount of dust everywhere, and the rooms were musty, as though they hadn't been aired for many days. I found the humidor on an unfamiliar table with two stale, dry cigarettes inside. Throwing open the French windows of the drawing room, we sat smoking in the darkness. "You ought to go away," I said. "It's pretty certain they'll trace your car." "Go away now, old sport? Go to Atlantic City for a week or up to Montreal." He wouldn't consider it. He couldn't possibly leave Daisy until he knew what she was going to do. He was clutching at some last hope, and I couldn't bear to shake him free. It was this night that he told me the strange story of his youth with Dan Cody. He told it to me because Jay Gatsby had broken up like glass against Tom's hard malice, and the secret extravaganza was played out. I think that he would have acknowledged anything now, without reserve, but he wanted to talk about Daisy. She was the first nice girl he'd ever known. In various unrevealed capacities, he had come in contact with such people, but always with indiscernible barbed wire between them. He found her excitingly desirable. He went to her house, at first, with other officers from Camp Taylor, and then alone. It amazed him. He had never been in such a beautiful house before, but what gave it an air of breathless intensity was that Daisy lived there. It was a casual thing to her, as his tent out at camp was to him. There was a ripe mystery about it, a hint of bedrooms upstairs before beautiful and cool than other bedrooms, of gay and radiant activities taking place through its corridors, and of romances that were not musty and laid away already in lavender, but fresh and breathing and redolent of the year's shining motor cars and of dances whose flowers were scarcely withered. Excited him, too, that many men had already loved Daisy. It increased her value in his eyes. He felt their presence all about the house, pervading the air with shades and echoes of still vibrant emotions. But he knew that he was in Daisy's house by a colossal accident. However glorious might be his future as Jay Gatsby, he was at present a penniless young man without a past, and at any moment the invisible cloak of his uniform might slip from his shoulders. So he made the most of his time. He took what he could get, ravenously and unscrupulously. Eventually, he took Daisy one still October night. He took her because he had no real right to touch her hand. He might have despised himself, for he had certainly taken her under false pretenses. I don't mean that he'd traded on his phantom millions, but he had deliberately given Daisy a sense of security. He let her believe that he was a person from much the same stratum as herself, that he was fully able to take care of her. As a matter of fact, he had no such faculties. He had no comfortable family standing behind him, and he was liable at the whim of an impersonal government to be blown anywhere about the world. But he didn't despise himself, and he didn't turn out as he had imagined. He had intentioned, probably, to take what he could and go, but now he found that he had committed himself to the following of a grail. He knew that Daisy was extraordinary, but he didn't realize just how extraordinary a nice girl could be. She vanished into her rich house, into her rich, full life, leaving Gatsby nothing. He felt married to her. That was all. When they met again 2 days later, it was Gatsby who was breathless, who was, somehow, betrayed. Her porch was bright with the bought luxury of starshine. The wicker of the settee squeaked fashionably as she turned towards him, and he kissed her curious and lovely mouth. She had caught a cold, and it made her voice huskier and more charming than ever, and Gatsby was overwhelmingly aware of the youth and mystery that wealth imprisons and preserves, of the freshness of many clothes, and of Daisy, gleaming like silver, safe and proud above the hot struggles of the poor. I can't describe to you how surprised I was to find out that I loved her old sport. I even hoped for a while that she'd throw me over, but she didn't, because she was in love with me too. She thought I knew a lot because I knew different things from her. Well, there I was, way off my ambitions, getting deeper in love every minute, and all of a sudden I didn't care. What was the use of doing great things if I couldn't have a better time telling her what I was going to do? On the last afternoon before he went abroad, he sat with Daisy in his arms for a long, silent time. It was a cold fall day with fire in the room and her cheeks flushed. Now and then she moved and he changed his arm a little, and once he kissed her dark shining hair. That afternoon he made them tranquil for a while, as if to give them a deep memory for the long parting as the next day promised. They had never been closer in their month of love, nor communicated more profoundly with one another, than when she brushed silent lips against his coat's shoulder, and when he touched the end of her fingers gently as if she were asleep. He did extraordinarily well in the war. He was a captain before he went to the front, and following the Argonne battles, he got his majority and the command of the divisional machine guns. After the armistice, he tried frantically to get home, but some complications and misunderstandings sent him to Oxford instead. He was worried now. There was a quality of nervous despair in Daisy's letters. She didn't see why he couldn't come. She was feeling the pressure of the world outside, and she wanted to see him and feel his presence beside her, and be reassured that she was doing the right thing after all. For Daisy was young, and her artificial world was redolent of orchids and pleasant, cheerful snobbery that orchestras which set the rhythm of the year, summing up the sadness of suggestiveness of life in new tunes. All night the saxophones wailed the helpless comments of the Beale Street Blues, while 100 pairs of golden and silver slippers shuffled the shining dust. At the gray tea hour, there were always rooms that throbbed incessantly with low, sweet fever, while fresh faces drifted here and there like rose petals blown about by the sad horns on the floor. Through this twilight universe, Daisy began to move again with the season. Suddenly, she was again keeping half a dozen dates a day with half a dozen men, and drowsing asleep at dawn with the beads and chiffon of an evening dress tangled among dying orchids on the floor beside her bed. And all the time, something within her was crying for a decision. She wanted her life shaped now, immediately, and the decision must be made by some force of love, of money, of unquestionable practicality that was close at hand. That force took shape in the middle of spring by the arrival of Tom Buchanan. There was a wholesome bulkiness about his person and his position, and Daisy was flattered. Doubtless, there was a certain struggle and a certain relief. The letter reached Gatsby while he was still at Oxford. I'm gonna take a drink. Taking a drink. Early in this chapter, I say as I lean. Oh, I have a message. Absolutely. I try to do that before, but my life doesn't stop when I press record. Okay. It was dawn now on Long Island, and we went about opening the rest of the windows downstairs, filling the house with gold-turning light. The shadows of a tree fell abruptly across the dew, and ghostly birds began to sing among the blue leaves. There was a slow, pleasant movement in the air, scarcely a wind, promising a cool, lovely day. I don't think she ever loved him. Gatsby turned around from a window and looked at me challengingly. You must remember, old sport. She was very excited this afternoon. He told her those things in a way that frightened her, that made it look as if I was some kind of cheap sharper. And the result was she hardly knew what she was saying. He looked down gloomily. Of course, she might have loved him for just a minute when they were first married, and loved me even more then, don't you see? Suddenly he came out with a curious remark. In any case, he said, it was just personal. What could you make of that except to suspect some intensity in his conception of the affair that couldn't be measured? He came back from France, then Tom and Daisy were still on their wedding trip, and made a miserable but irresistible journey to Louisville on the last of his army pay. He stayed there a week, walking the streets where their footsteps had clicked together through the November night, and revisiting the out-of-the-way places to which they had driven in her white car. Just as Daisy's house had always seemed to him more mysterious and gay than other houses, so his idea of the city itself, even though she was gone from it, was pervaded with melancholy beauty. He left, feeling that if he had searched harder, he might have found her, that he was leaving her behind. The day coach, he was penniless now, was hot. He went out to the open vestibule and sat down on a folding chair, and the station slid away, and the backs of unfamiliar buildings moved by. Then, out into the spring fields, there was a yellow trolley raced them for a minute with people in it who might once have seen the pale magic of her face along a casual street. The track curved, and now it was going away from the sun, which, as it sank lower, seemed to spread itself in benediction over the vanishing city where she had drawn her breath. He stretched out his hand desperately, as if to snatch only a wisp of air to save a fragment of the spot that she had made lovely for him. But it was all going by too fast now for his blurred eyes, and he knew that he had lost that part of it, the freshest and the best, forever. It was 9 o'clock when we finished breakfast and went out on the porch. The night had made a sharp difference in the weather, and there was an autumn flavor in the air. The gardener, the last one of Gatsby's former servants, came to the foot of the steps. "I'm going to drain the pool today, Mr. Gatsby. Leaves will start falling pretty soon, and there's always trouble in the pipes." "Don't do it today," Gatsby answered. He turned to me apologetically. "You know, old sport, I never used that pool all summer." I looked up my watch and I stood up. 20 minutes to my train. I didn't want to go into the city. I wasn't worth a decent stroke of work, but it was more than that. I didn't want to leave Gatsby. I missed that train, and then another, before I could get myself away. "I'll call you up," I said finally. "Do, old sport. I'll call you about noon." We walked slowly down the steps. "I suppose Daisy'll call, too." He looked at me anxiously, as if he'd hoped I'd corroborate this. "I suppose so. Well, goodbye." We shook hands and I started away. Just before I reached the head, I remembered something and turned around. "They're a rotten crowd," I shouted across the lawn. "You're worth a whole damn bunch of them put together." I've always been glad I said that. It was the only compliment I ever gave him, because I disapproved of him from beginning to end. First he nodded politely, and then his face broke into a radiant and understanding smile, as if we'd been in ecstatic cahoots on the fact all the time. His gorgeous pink rag of a suit made a bright spot of color against the white steps, and I thought of that night when I first came to his ancestral home 3 months before. The lawn and drive had been crowded with faces of those who guessed at his corruption, and he'd stood on those steps concealing his incorruptible dream as he waved them goodbye. I thanked him for his hospitality. We are always thanking him for that, I and the others. "Goodbye," I called. "I enjoyed breakfast, Gatsby." Up in the city, I tried for a while to list the quotations of an interminable amount of stock, and then I fell asleep at my swivel chair. Before noon, the phone woke me, and I started with a sweat breaking out of my forehead. It was Jordan Baker. She often called me up at this hour, because of the uncertainty of her own movements between hotels, clubs, and private houses had made her hard to find any other way. Usually, her voice came over the wire as something fresh and cool, as if a divot from a green golf links had come sailing in at the office window, but this morning it seemed harsh and dry. "I've left Daisy's house," she said. "I'm at Hempstead, and I'm going down to Southampton this afternoon." Probably it had been tactful to leave Daisy's house, but the act annoyed me, and her next remark made me rigid. "You weren't so nice to me last night." How could it have mattered then? Silence for a moment. Then, "However, I want to see you." "I want to see you too. Suppose I don't go to Southampton, and I come to town this afternoon." "No, I don't think this afternoon." "Very well. It's impossible this afternoon. We talked like that for a while, and then abruptly we weren't talking any longer. I don't know which one of us hung up with a sharp clip, but I know I didn't really care. I couldn't have talked to her across a tea table today, and if I never talked to her again in this world. I called Gatsby's house a few minutes later, but the line was busy. I tried four times. Finally, an exasperated central told me that the wire was being kept open for long distance from Detroit. Taking out my timetable, I drew a small circle around that 3:50 train. Then I leaned back in my chair and tried to think. It was just noon. When I passed the ash heaps on the train that morning, I had crossed deliberately to the other side of the car. I suppose there'd be a curious crowd around there all day, with little boys searching for dark spots in the dusk, or some garrulous man telling over and over what had happened until it became less and less real even to him, and he could tell it no longer, and Myrtle Wilson's tragic achievements was forgotten. Now I want to go back a little and tell what had happened at the garage after we left there for the night before. They had difficulty in locating the sinister Catherine. Locating the sister Catherine. She must have broken her rule against drinking that night, for when she arrived, she was stupid with liquor and unable to understand that an ambulance had already gone to Flushing. When they convinced her of this, she immediately fainted, as if it was an intolerable part of the affair. Someone, kind or curious, took her by car and drove her in the wake of her sister's body. Until long after midnight, a changing crowd lapped against the front of the garage, while George Wilson rocked himself back and forth on the couch inside. For a while, the door of the office was open, and everyone who came into the garage glanced irresistibly through it. Finally, someone said it was a shame and closed the door. Michaelis and several other men were still with him, first four or five men, later two or three men. Still later, Michaelis had to ask the stranger to wait here 15 minutes longer while he went back to his own place and made a pot of coffee. After that, he stayed there with Wilson alone until dawn. At about 3 o'clock, the quality of Wilson's incoherent muttering changed. He grew quieter and began to talk about a yellow car. He announced that he had a way of finding out whom the yellow car belonged to, and then he blurted out a couple of months ago his wife had come from the city with her face bruised and her nose swollen. But when he heard himself say it, he flinched and began to cry. "Oh my God," he said in a groaning voice. Michaelis made a clumsy attempt to distract him. "How long have you been married, George? Come on there, try and sit a minute and answer my question. How long have you been married?" 12 years. "Ever had any children?" "Come on, George, sit still. I asked you a question. Did you ever have any children?" The hard brown beetles kept thudding against the dull light, and whenever Michaelis heard a car go tearing along the road outside, it sounded to him like the car hadn't stopped a few hours before. He didn't like to go into the garage because the workbench was stained where the body had been lying, and so he moved uncomfortably around the office. He knew every object in it before morning, and from time to time sat down beside Wilson, trying to keep him more quiet. "Have you gone to a church? Have you got a church you go to sometimes, George? Maybe even if you hadn't been there for a long time. Maybe I could call up the church and get a priest to come over and talk to you, don't you see? Don't belong to any. You ought to have a church, George, for times like this. You must have gone to church once. Didn't you get married in a church? Listen, George, listen to me. Didn't you get married in a church?" That was a long time ago. The effort of answering broke the rhythm of his rocking, and for a moment he was silent, and then the same half-knowing, half-bewildered look came back into his faded eyes. "Look in that drawer over there," he said, pointing at the desk. "Which drawer?" "That drawer. That one." Michaelis opened the drawer nearest his hand. There was nothing in it but a small, expensive dog leash that made of leather and braided silver, which was apparently new. "This?" he inquired, holding it up. Wilson stared and nodded. "I found it yesterday afternoon. She tried to tell me about it, but I knew something was funny." "You mean your wife bought it?" "She had it wrapped up in tissue paper on her bureau." Michaelis didn't see anything odd in that, and he gave Wilson a dozen reasons why his wife might have bought a dog leash, but conceivably Wilson had heard some of these same explanations before from Myrtle, because he then began saying, "Oh my God," in a whisper. His comforter left several explanations in the air. "Then he killed her," said Wilson. His mouth dropped open suddenly. "Who did?" "I have a way of finding out." "You're morbid, George," said his friend. "This has been a strain to you, and you don't know what you're saying. You better try and sit still until morning." "He murdered her." "It was an accident, George." Wilson shook his head, his eyes narrowed, and his mouth widened slightly with a ghost of a superior "hmph." "I know," he said defiantly. "I'm one of those trusting fellows, and I don't think any harm to nobody. But when I get to know a thing, I know it. It was the man's in that car. She ran out to speak to him, and he wouldn't stop." Michaelis had seen it, too, but it hadn't occurred to him that there was any special significance to it. He'd believed that Mrs. Wilson had been running away from her husband rather than trying to stop that particular car. "How could she have been like that?" "She's a deep one," said Wilson, as if that answered the question. He began to rock again, and Michaela stood, twisting the leash in his hand. "Maybe you've got some friend I could telephone for, George?" This was a forlorn hope. He was almost sure that Wilson had no friend. There was not enough of him for his wife. He was glad a little later he had noticed a change in the room, a blue quickening by the window, and he realized that dawn wasn't far off. About 5 o'clock, it was blue enough outside to snap off the light. Wilson's glazed eyes turned out to the ash heaps, where a small gray cloud took on fantastic shapes and scurried here and there in the faint wind. "I spoke to her," he muttered after a long silence. "I told her she might fool me, but she wouldn't fool God. I took her to the window." With an effort, he got up and walked to the rear window and leaned his face pressed against it. "And I said, 'God knows what you've been doing, everything you've been doing. You may fool me, but you can't fool God.'" Standing behind him, Michaelis saw with a shock that he was looking at the eyes of T.J. Eckelberg, which had emerged in a pale enormous from the dissolving night. God sees everything, repeated Wilson. That is an advertisement, Michaelis assured him. Something made him turn away from the window and look back into the room, but Wilson stood there a long time, his face close to the window and nodding into the twilight.
Oh, my legs are uncomfortable.
By 6 o'clock, Michaelis was worn out and grateful for the sound of a car stopping outside. It was one of the watchers of the night before who had promised to come back. So he cooked breakfast for three, which he and the other man ate together. Wilson was quieter now, and Michaelis went home to sleep. When he awoke 4 hours later, he hurried back to the garage, and Wilson was gone. His movements, he was on foot at the time, were afterward traced to Port Roosevelt and then Gad's Hill, where he bought a sandwich that he didn't eat and a cup of coffee. He must have been tired and walking slowly, for he didn't reach Gad's Hill until noon. Thus far, there was no difficulty in accounting for his time. There were boys who had seen a man acting sort of crazy, and motorists at whom he stared at oddly from the side of the road. Then for 3 or 4 hours, he had disappeared from view. The police, on the strength of what had been said to Michaelis, that he had a way of finding out, supposed that he had spent that time going from garage to garage thereabout inquiring for a yellowed car. On the other hand, no garage man who had seen him ever came forward, and perhaps he'd had an easier, surer way of finding out what he wanted to know. By 2:30, he was in West Egg, where he asked someone for the way to Gatsby's home. So by that time, he knew Gatsby's name. At 2:00, Gatsby put on his bathing suit and left a word with the butler that if anybody phoned, it was to be brought to him at the pool. He stopped at the garage for a pneumonic mattress that had amused his guests during the summer, and the chauffeur helped him pump it up. Then he gave instructions that the open car wasn't to be taken out under any circumstances. And this was strange, because the front right fender had needed a repair. Gatsby shouldered the mattress and started for the pool. Once he stopped and shifted in a little, the chauffeur asked him if he needed any help, but he shook his head and in a moment disappeared among the yellowing trees. No telephone message arrived, but the butler went without his sleep and waited until 4:00, until long after there was anyone to give it if it came out. I have an idea that Gatsby himself didn't believe it would come, and perhaps he no longer cared. If that was true, he must have felt that he had lost the old warm world, paid a high price for living too long with a single dream. He must have looked up at an unfamiliar sky through frightening leaves and shivered as he found what a grotesque thing a rose is and how raw the sunlight was upon the scarcely created grass. A new world, material without being real, where poor ghosts breathing dreams like air drifted fortuitously about, like the ashen, fantastic figure gliding towards him through the amorphous trees. The chauffeur, he was one of Wolfsheim's prodigies, heard the shots. Afterwards, he could only say that he hadn't thought anything much about them. I drove from the station directly to Gatsby's house, and my rushing anxiously up the front steps was the first thing that alarmed anybody. But they knew then, I firmly believe. With scarcely a word said, four of us, the chauffeur, butler, and gardener, and I hurried down to the pool. There was a faint, barely perceptible movement of the water as the fresh flow from one end urged its way towards the drain at the other. With little ripples that were hardly in the shadows of the waves, the laden mattress moved irregularly down in the pool. A small gust of wind that scarcely corrugated the surface was enough to disturb its accidental course with its accidental burden. The touch of a cluster of leaves revolved its slow tracing like a leg of transit, and a thin red circle in the water. It was after we started with Gatsby towards the house that the gardener saw Wilson's body, a little way off the grass, and the Holocaust was complete. Whew! Okay. There's only one chapter left. That's a heavy chapter. But, man, God, this is a good book. It just feels like, you know, we'll talk about it later. I hope you enjoyed this chapter, and I hope you'll join me tomorrow for the last chapter. And I hope that you'll give me some suggestions about what book you'd like to hear me read. If not, I'm going to pick something. probably Misery by Stephen King, because I feel like The Boy in the Striped Pajamas might just be too sad. Anyway, thank you for listening, angels, and I hope you have a wonderful night.